We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Hour 2 of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening this morning. The producers for our program are Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frains at the controls this morning. In this Hour of Focus, we'll be talking about an issue that certainly over the past few years has been one of the most contentious domestic political issues here in the United States, and that's immigration reform. Now, while it seems that there is a general agreement that changes are needed to deal with particularly the problem of people who are here illegally, there is no consensus on exactly what should be done. Certainly, there are some people who argue that individuals, undocumented immigrants who are here in this country, should simply be deported, that it's a matter of law and law enforcement. Other people say that people who are undocumented should, in fact, be given the chance to stay here and become citizens, or some blending of those two things. So this morning in this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about these issues. And we have two guests here who are experts on immigration policy. Peter Scarry from Boston College and Daniel Tischner from University of Oregon. They are both here to take part in the Klein Symposium. This is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy here on the U of I campus. This is their spring symposium. It takes place today and tomorrow, and it looks at amnesty and immigration reform, some of the issues involved and some of the challenges and some of the opportunities. That's sort of the title that they have put on it. They'll be speaking this afternoon at a roundtable discussion and public forum this afternoon, beginning at 3 in the Illini Union, and then in the Beckman Institute Auditorium. There'll also be an evening event tonight from 7:30 to 9, and they'll both be speaking. These events are all open to the public, so certainly anybody who is in our community who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Let me just take a moment or two here to tell you a little bit more about our two guests. Peter Scarry is professor of political science at Boston College. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's a former research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and at one time served as congressional aide to Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He's currently writing a book about the integration of Muslims into American society. His other work includes the book Mexican Americans, the Ambivalent Minority, published by the Harvard University Press. It was awarded the 1993 LA Times Book Prize. Our other guest, Daniel Tischner, is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Social Science and also Senior Faculty Fellow at the Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics. This is at the University of Oregon. His book, Dividing Lines, The Politics of Immigration Control in America, won the American Political Science Association's Gladys Camera Award for the best book in American national policy. His forthcoming works include Faustian Bargains, The Origins and Development of America's Illegal Immigration Dilemma. He's also testified and provided expert briefings to Congress on immigration policy and politics. I'm very pleased they can be both here in the studio to talk with us. Questions also are welcome to. Individuals who are listening out there are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, or you may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'd like to get in as many people as are interested, and so folks will help us by being brief in their comments. Thank you both very much for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
We appreciate it. It is such a broad area, and I think if I didn't think this before, having looked a little bit of some of the things that Professor Tischner has written, makes me think about how if you talk about the immigration problem, put that in quotes, then you have to ask, well, what do you think the problem is? And depending upon how you come to it, the answer may be, well, you know, you may have one answer and Professor Scarry may have another answer, and a lot of different people are going to have different answers. So having said that, I'll start maybe with Daniel Tischner. If I ask the question, what is the immigration problem, what would you say?
Well, I think that you're hitting really the crux of the issue in that Americans have a very hard time, and policymakers as well, defining exactly what the problem is. There's a great deal of disagreement on this. So for many Americans, the problem is that we need to bring people out of the shadows of this, caste status where one lacks any full membership, and the challenges that poses to liberal democracy for people to, you know, fear being pulled over driving down the road and potentially facing deportation and lacking opportunities for their family. Others would define it as a problem of security, of rule of law, of the challenges of porous borders to the nation's sovereignty. Yet others would say the issue really is one of rationalizing economic exchange so that you match willing workers with willing employers. Yet others would say the issue is really one of economic fairness and how undocumented immigration may enervate things like working standards, minimum wage, and so forth. So there are a host of ways people define this problem, and that's really one of the real challenges facing the Obama administration and those on the Hill who want to reform this, is the extent to which there is more cacophony than symphony on this issue.
Well, let me ask that same question to Peter Skerry, and maybe you can take that a little bit further, because the Obama administration has said they want to make immigration reform a priority. But we know also that over the past couple of years, as much as this has been discussed, there seems to be very little consensus.
Yeah. Clearly, there's very little consensus. And while the Obama administration wants to make this a priority, it wants lots of things it's not going to get. And I even doubt how much it wants to make it a priority, frankly. It's got bigger issues, bigger problems to address. I don't see this really coming on the agenda, certainly between now and the elections. But I would just go back to your question and Dan's answer. I would agree with all the things that Dan pointed to. But my judgment, my personal judgment would be that the real problem here, and this in a way comes back to Obama and the politics of the present era, is that the immigration problem, I think, is really another example of the lack of faith and confidence Americans have in their governmental and political institutions. And I have in mind, when I say that, very I'll be very straightforward, that segment of our population that is so disaffected with our immigration policy, the kinds of folks who think that illegal immigrants are criminals. I don't share that position, but I listen real hard to people who have it. And I think this is in the same vein with what happened with Hurricane Katrina and the governmental failure there and the oversight of the financial and mortgage markets. I think this is an example of the inability of our government to provide, in its most basic sense, a sense of security and social order to not only to illegal immigrants, who in many ways lack it too, but to the people who are Americans, who are American citizens, and who rightfully feel that this is, you know, their country, and don't feel like there's any order and control are being exerted over this situation.
Well, what do you, though, say to people who would say that really the bottom line issue here is one of law, law and order, law enforcement, that if you have people who are here illegally, they've broken the law, so that so they would say the response of that should be pretty simple and straightforward, just in the way that you would deal with anybody who's a lawbreaker.
Yeah, well, I sympathize with the outrage that is behind that perspective, but I don't share it. And I would say if there are 11 million illegal immigrants in the United States today who have broken the law, then there are at least that many, arguably a whole lot more Americans who are complicit in having helped them break the law, because they don't come here by and large. I mean, the overwhelming preponderance of evidence is that people come here to work. they've been hired by Americans who help them evade the law. So I think there's dirty hands here all around. So I find it very hard to simply point to the illegal immigrants as criminals and malfeasance.
Yeah, and if I could just add to what Peter's saying, I mean, what's striking to me is the extent to which a majority of Americans really are wrestling with this issue. There are a larger number of Americans I've seen in polling over the last, you know, 5 years who are more supportive of some kind of earned citizenship, some kind of legalization, and more kind of varied opinions on that than you saw in 86 when we had our first real amnesty program, in which it was decidedly unpopular and resolutely so. But what's striking and what I think captures the extent to which Americans, I think, are individually wrestling with this is that the same polls find individuals who say, no, I don't support forced deportation for the vast majority of undocumented immigrants, and at the same time express, as Peter was putting, profound cynicism about the ability of the government to enforce its laws and control its borders. So, you know, I think that kind of captures how a lot of Americans are trying to be very fair-minded but are also very upset about what they see as kind of ineffectiveness of a broken system.
Well, let me ask you this, and it maybe, again, comes off of something that Professor Scarry said. How do you respond to those people who say that really the best way that we have of addressing the issue does indeed go through employers, that they're the ones who are in the position to know who they're employing, do they have documentation or not, and that the responsibility, much of the responsibility should be on them, and that we really have not done that. We have not made them responsible to the extent that they should be. And one of our best ways to deal with this issue is right there with people who employ them.
I mean, employer sanctions first came up in the 1950s as a proposal, and it was proposed by a very liberal Democrat, and it foundered and finally was adopted in 86 as part of the Immigration Reform and Control Act. But it was a toothless tiger in the 86 legislation. There was no means of verifying employee eligibility. It was not really enforced with very much vigor. And so we, you know, when it was adopted in the 80s, there was a very broad agreement among many policymakers that, indeed, as you say, David, that one of the best ways to address the magnet of undocumented immigration is to go at the workplace. But that raises a host of issues that Americans are uncomfortable with, like a national ID card or some kind of firm identification system. So the question is whether, you know, the next time we do immigration reform, employer sanctions is almost certain to be part of the package. But will it be a toothless tiger like the past, or will we have some enforcement mechanisms that really work with it? So,
what do you think about that?
Yeah, I substantially agree with what Dan just said. I guess I'd add that workplace has been essentially bypassed for the longest time because of the politics of this. I mean, it's been much easier to focus on enforcement along the border, policies that I have supported. I think our border does need to be reinforced and better monitored. But that was obviously the easy part because the opposition there was relatively minor. We were avoiding pinching sectors of American society that are able to push back employers. But having said that, I think that's the next step is clear how we're going to get there because the employers fought back, but they had lots of help from civil libertarians, from immigrant rights groups. It wasn't just employers who resisted employer sanctions, of course.
We have two guests here in the studio this morning here for this Point of Focus. Let me just introduce them again. The last person you heard is Peter Scarry. He's professor of political science at Boston College. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also joining us here is Daniel Tischner. He is professor of social science and senior faculty fellow at the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. And the two of them are here visiting the campus. They'll be taking part in the Klein Symposium for this spring. which is looking at immigration issues. This is taking place today and tomorrow, sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy. If you'd like to find out more about the center, about the events associated with the symposium, and you have internet access, the easiest thing to do is go to their website, which is www.kleincenter, that's Klein with a C, kleincenter.uiuc.edu. The two of them will be taking part in a roundtable discussion this afternoon and an event tonight, and they are open to the public. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're interested in listening in, taking part, you're welcome to do that. Questions here are welcome, too. We have several ready to go. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a number of callers here. In fact, the lines are full. People will help us by trying to be brief, but we'll try to get in as many people as we possibly can. And we'll be starting in on, let's see, how about line number one? And I think that's Champaign. Hello?
Yeah, Champaign.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I think employment is the right way to go, but you need to look at employment south of the border. You can build a fence 100 feet high, and as long as people are desperately poor in those countries, it's going to be a semi-permeable membrane, and they're going to find some way to come across, but with great casualties. I think you probably know about the Devil's Highway and the 14 men that perished in the desert there several years ago, I think 2001, and also the public discourse is focused on Mexico as if all the people who are here illegally are Mexicans or South or Central Americans, but a lot of people overstay their visas, and they come from Europe, they come from and through Canada, so if we really want to keep illegal immigration out, we should be helping those countries achieve a level of standard of living so that people wouldn't have to desperately try to cross the desert at great risk.
All right. Good. Yeah, I appreciate the comment, the question.
I think that's a very astute question, and I want to start with a point that the caller made in terms of our fixation on Mexican undocumented immigrants and you know, a lot of the research that's out there suggests that that's about 60% of the total. But we have a number of other immigrants out of legal status who have overstayed their visas. And so, you know, and have arrived here legally. And so I think we have to kind of go beyond some of the stereotypes of who is the undocumented immigrant. The other thing that I like about the question in terms of focusing south of the border is also for us to think about how do Mexicans view the border? And it's a porous border both directions. And if you listen and to Mexican voices and read Mexican newspapers and so forth on this issue, they're very concerned about the flow of guns and money, laundered money and so forth flowing from our side of the border, their direction, and likewise thus are concerned about their security and so forth as a result.
I'm really interested in this point of the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico and how we deal with this issue. And I'm glad it came up because, Peter Scarry, I know that you were involved in a project to think about this that also involved your school, Brookings and Duke, and made some recommendations. And one of the things you said really needed some particular attention was Mexico. You know, given the fact that, yes, that's not the only place that we have people coming from, that is a significant issue. How do the two governments think about this, do you think?
Well, it's a great question. Let me just back up a second because I really want to take a different point of departure here. I really disagree with the perspective of the caller, and I disagree with Dan. 60% of illegal immigrants are Mexican. 80% of illegal immigrants are Hispanic. Obviously, lots of Americans can't distinguish between Salvadoreños and Guatemalans and Mexicans. And they all speak Spanish. I don't think I don't think anyone should be offended by the fact that Americans see 80% of illegal immigrants speaking Spanish, and they and they have a they make an association. I don't think that's a stereotype. I think that's a reality. Immigrant rights organizations don't want to face up to that. I think lots of Americans don't want to face up to it. I think I just heard two people who don't want to face up to it. So you know, let's be clear. And among those number of people are included the overstayers. I mean, the overstayers aren't some other group that's sort of, you know, clearly different. I suspect more of the overstayers are from other parts of the world. But bottom line, 80% of illegal immigrants are Hispanics. And so I think we have to, you know, own up to that. It's also the case that the largest group of legal immigrants in the United States who are admitted every year, the, you know, 1 million or so every year who were admitted, are also from Mexico. They're certainly under the family unification policy. So that you know, Mexico is a huge part of this picture. It's this is not, and you can't have it both ways. You can't say we ought to do, you know, think about Mexico, develop Mexico, and then deny the fact that so many illegal immigrants come from Mexico. I mean, it's all of a piece. Coming more directly to your question, clearly we have to, you know, address Mexico and its problems. But I, you know, this is a short range versus long range dynamic. The caller suggests that we have to, you know, somehow develop Mexico. Well, great. I mean, I just got through saying, I thought I heard Dan agree with me, that, you know, we have incapacities, you know, in terms of how we, you know, address our own policies to help our own nation. I don't have much faith that we're going to get very far helping Mexico to develop. That's a very complicated question, even if we had the will to do it. And it's not clear to me we do. It's not clear to me that we, you know, that the Mexicans have the will to do what they need to do. I mean, we've been a solution for the elites of Mexico to their problems. You know, they've exported their unemployed to us. So having said all that, rather pessimistically, you know, we can't ignore Mexico. We have to do what we can. I do think the issue of guns going south, you know, is an issue, but I mean, I don't think those are commensurable. Those are two different. Those are two different domains. I don't think one is a response to the other. But we should do what we can, and we ought to do what we can to make sure that the violence that's, you know, crowding our border doesn't come across any more than it does. We are complicit in some of that, given our drug usage. There's no denying that. But we have to be very choosy and very focused on what we can do and what we can't do.
Yeah. Anything that you want to respond to?
You know, what strikes me is that about 100% of the enforcement efforts seem to really target, you know, those of Latino background. And so, you know, it is, you know, a real challenge, I think, on this issue that we tend to always have a particular complexion, a particular language and so forth in mind with this when 20% is not inconsequential in terms of this problem.
Let's talk with another caller. This is Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to point out something you really haven't mentioned yet, and that's the fact this whole thing is based upon who got here first. And the Hispanics were here first, and if all honesty be realized, the Carib Indians would have liked to have another consideration of burning the Santa Maria and the Ninza and the Pinta to the waterline, wouldn't they?
I'm not sure what kind of response you're looking for or we can get.
Well, the caller is obviously pointing to our history that obviously there are Aboriginal peoples who weren't the Hispanics. They were Aztec and Inca Indians who were here long before all of us, and that's a long, sad history that most Americans tend to forget. Some don't and obsess on it. I just don't think that that's a very helpful perspective with today's problems. I mean, the fact is that Mexicans who come here, if we're talking about Mexicans who come here and cross that border, they know that's not an imaginary border. They know it's a real border. They know what being a Mexican is. They know what being an American is. They certainly know that they have a southern border with Guatemala, and they're not very open about letting Guatemalans come into their border. So there's such a thing today, our history of Aboriginal peoples notwithstanding, of nationalism, even in this era of supposedly of post-nationalism. So let's deal with what's in front of us. We have Mexicans. We have people from other countries. We have people in America. And we have a problem here of these movements of large people across widely recognized national borders.
What I was getting at, sir, is we've got to take a more open view about it. I mean, obviously the people here before us, they accept the incoming people. We're going to have to accept it, too, at some point.
Well, sir, it's not clear to me they accepted them. I think they fought back rather hard to keep them out. I think we have to be more open. I think we could agree on that.
I am reminded whenever I've been in the National Archives looking at this issue, there's always a host of cartoons that picture Native Americans on the shore as the pilgrims are pulling up in their ships, and they say, now might be a good time to impose immigration restrictions. So there certainly over the generations have been many who have been aware of this this situation.
Well, at the risk of bringing in another issue here, which is enough, would be enough to keep us talking for another hour. Let me ask this question. If we acknowledge the fact that people come here, that a lot of the people who come here, they come here to work. They come here for economic opportunity. Is it really necessary that we create some way for them to become citizens? Or should we simply acknowledge that we need the labor and they're here to work, and that after some period of time, they might want to go back home? So what we really need to think about is, first, some kind of guest worker program so that we can create a structure for people to work, pay taxes, have their interests looked after so we can provide them with some kind of protections in the workplace, but that we should decouple that from the question of citizenship.
Mm-hmm. And guest worker programs clearly have been politically popular with certain leaders at various points in our history. What stands out to me, I'll raise a couple of things. The first is that whether one wants to look at European guest worker programs or the U.S. experience with the Bracero program, which we had in place from the 40s on through the 60s, mm-hmm. Is that these programs have often promised certain protections for those workers. So in terms of working conditions, wages, and other protections, which have rarely been successfully enforced. There's kind of been a tradition of abuse in the U.S. case. In the European case, what a lot of scholars will tell you is that the guest worker programs are rarely ones in which these workers are truly guests. They come to stay. So in many ways, they've often been a pipe dream to think that status is temporary. I guess one other thing I'll throw in this regard is that in the U.S. experience with guest worker programs, legal guest workers have often been accompanied by flows of undocumented workers as well. So all these things raise question marks. It's not that it's impossible to construct a temporary mm-hmm. worker program that will try to address and ameliorate past problems, but we don't have a good track record in this regard.
Yeah, on this we agree. Yeah. You know, a guest worker program, if you think about it, is a kind of, you know, a gate through which we want workers to come. And, you know, there's all sorts of problems about how we treat them once they get through the gate. There's also questions about, even in this country, I would say, that the guest workers, you know, want to stay over time and they change their minds. Mm-hmm. But also, just think about that gate along the border. You know, people who you know, cross borders informally, shall we say, are used to kind of doing things their way. So, you know, are they going to go through the gate that we set up for them, or are they going to go around the gate? This is why the guest worker program last, you know, in the 50s and 60s helped begin this flow of illegal immigrants, because when people start coming, they say, hey, why do I have to go through that gate and go through that rigmarole? I'm going to go around it. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of many reasons why guest worker programs have never worked. And it's unfortunate that the Schumer Graham proposal that's been put on the table in the last few weeks once again relies on this.
But I would add that guest worker programs have almost invariably been part of the compromise that's worked out in terms of final immigration reform on undocumented immigration.
Right, but because we get compromises like that, we're in the fix we're in.
Okay, so again, I guess going back to the thing that I was thinking about is that by separating these issues, citizenship and coming here to work, that doesn't necessarily – in fact, it sounds like what you're saying is that doesn't make things any easier. That doesn't make things less complicated.
No, I don't – it doesn't make any things any easier. And actually, I was just thinking how There's another version of this that's gotten bandied about recently, if I can suggest it. And I guess I'm thinking of it because, as I recall, George Will is a graduate of the University of Illinois, and he wrote a column this Sunday arguing that we should do away with birthright citizenship, for example, which would, you know, you could say, well, we had a guest worker program, and people came, and if their kids who were born here didn't become citizens right away, well, then we would have a better shot at delinking, as you say, work and citizenship. Yeah. But I think down that road lies folly. I think we will only exacerbate our problems and wind up more looking like something that Europe has, with large non-citizen populations that don't have any ties or any investment in the society.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And another issue that I think, in terms of why temporary workers doesn't solve the problem, or in terms of their linkage with citizenship, invoke a political philosopher, Joe Cairns, up at the University of Toronto, who would make the case that ethically, the longer one is here and the longer one works and pays taxes, the stronger the claim to membership. So one can imagine a situation like for Turks in Germany for years and years, where one would work and be loyal to the state in terms of paying taxes and contributing to the community, and yet not have full membership. And that's really problematic for a liberal democracy.
Let me introduce again the guests. We are past our midpoint here. We have some other callers. I'll get right to them in just a moment. But I'd like you to know that the two people that you're listening to are Daniel Tischner. He's the last that you heard. He's the Philip Knight Professor of Social Science and also Senior Faculty Fellow at the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics at University of Oregon. Also here with us is Peter Scarry. He's Professor of Political Science at Boston College and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. They are here visiting the campus to take part in the Klein Symposium for spring, looking at issues of immigration. This is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy. They'll be speaking at a couple of events. There'll be a roundtable discussion this afternoon at 3 in the Illini Union, room 314, an evening event tonight at 7. This is in the Beckman Institute Auditorium, and these events are open to the public. Anybody who is interested should feel welcome to stop by. You want to find out more about the Klein Center, about this event, you can go to their website, which is Klein Center. That's Klein with a C. KleinCenter.uiuc.edu. We have a number of callers here. We'll go on and talk next with somebody on a cell phone and line 3. Hello. Caller there on line 3. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hi.
Yes.
I just have a couple of quick comments, and I missed the first 15 minutes, so I hope I don't repeat something. The first comment is the whole idea of, you know, whether you're here legally or not, you have a child while you're here, and they automatically get citizenship. I don't understand how that ever came about, and because it seems absolutely ridiculous to me. Just because you're in some country and have a child, automatically that child is a citizen of that country. And the second comment I have is the whole idea of illegal immigration. I mean, the whole word illegal. You know, everybody else that does things that are illegal have to pay the consequences. And I don't understand why with immigration, it's like it doesn't matter. I mean, that's the reason it is because we've never enforced it. The word illegal has no meaning in this whole argument because it's never been truly enforced. And so it's not illegal immigration. It's just uncontrolled immigration in the end. That's what it boils down to, because the illegal part of it has never truly been enforced. And everybody else has to pay the consequences of their actions when they do something illegal. And I don't understand why this has been such a difficult problem for the government to deal with.
I appreciate the question, and I want to give the guests a chance to respond. I'm sure that the caller speaks for a lot of people, expresses the opinion of a lot of people, who go back to this issue that the bottom line issue here is a legal issue and law enforcement, and it's not something that we've ever really dealt with as we should.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the caller's questions. I also appreciate the tone in which he posed them, which was, you know, very straightforward and earnest. Some people put it in much more overblown ways, and I appreciate her concern and her tone. And these are difficult questions. The first one I would say about birthright citizenship, I mean – how it came about? Well, it reflects the post-Civil War amendments to our Constitution, and birthright citizenship was basically comes out of the 14th Amendment. I don't think the framers of the 14th Amendment ever intended quite what we're dealing with today. And I think there may be a constitutional argument that it doesn't make sense constitutionally. But in practical terms, I would just point out to the caller that if she's thinking that people come here to give birth to children so that they can become citizens and or take advantage of programs and benefits that we have here, there's very little evidence to support that. I just don't believe that's why people migrate across the borders. And at the same time, if you look at countries as countries in Europe that don't have not had this kind of regime, this kind of law, that people have to, you know, live in a certain country for a long period of time and go through all sorts of hoops. Their experience with immigrants is much worse than ours. Germany comes to mind, and they've begun to change it. You wind up with these huge populations of people who have no investment in the society. I think birthright citizenship makes a lot of sense for those reasons. And then her second point about illegal immigration. I would tell her that I spent a lot of time with Border Patrol agents. And I've always been struck that Border Patrol agents make a distinction almost invariably, automatically. I've never had to ask this question. Sooner or later, they will volunteer when you spend time with them that, you know what, if I were in their shoes, that is to say the illegal immigrants, I'd be doing the same thing. I'd be coming across that border trying to better myself and my situation for my family. And I think that has to tell you this is a very special kind of situation. You don't find cops on the beat saying, if I were in that guy's shoes, I'd be dealing drugs or robbing banks. So that the people who have to enforce these laws understand that, yes, it's a law. It's a misdemeanor to cross that border without inspection. There's lots of consequences of it. This is a big, difficult problem. But that one, I hope, vignette would suggest to you that this is not something that's any ordinary crime. It's a very difficult situation in which we're all complicit. People come across that border to work because Americans will hire them. So if people are upset about illegal immigrants, then maybe we should go and start putting in jail some of those who employ them. And we did do that. Certainly the Bush administration started doing that and got lots of pushback. Not that I'm suggesting that was necessarily the right way to go, but
I know there's a lot of callers who are patiently waiting, so I will be very brief and just note that we have to ask ourselves what is illegal and what is criminal, and there's a distinction. People, when they're speeding down the highway at 75 miles per hour, are doing something that's illegal. We normally don't define that as criminal. Murder is clearly criminal, and there's a huge spectrum between those two things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something for people to reflect on. I think the term criminal activity surrounding crossing a porous border is too easily bandied about. I'll leave it there.
Can I add to that? I appreciate Dan's brevity, but because I went on. But his point is well taken. But just like when we have lots of people disobeying traffic laws or other such misdemeanor laws, the effect can be very socially destabilizing. And as the woman said, it's not illegal immigration. It's uncontrollable immigration. I think she hit the nail on the head. I think lots of Americans feel that this is a situation out of control. Mm-hmm. And that makes people very anxious, justifiably anxious, particularly in this economic situation. But even aside from that, there's a basic issue of social order here that people feel is fraying. And I share the view that that's troubling.
Well, I want to come in just for a second here to come back to Dan Tischner. We have the situation on the ground. We have a lot of people who are here who are undocumented. There's no way we're going to be able to round them up and deport them. So the question is, as a practical matter, you know, what do we do? And if we create some sort of a way for them to be here legally, then how do we take into account the fact that they broke the law when they came here? I mean, should there have to be some kind of penalty? I mean, something to acknowledge the fact that there was lawbreaking there.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. And, you know, all the proposals that are on the table have some version of earned citizenship in the plan that will involve some kind of fine, security check. In some cases, there's proposals of a touchback where you have to return to the place where you originated. Yeah. And, you know, it's probably a good idea to have some component of an earned component of this. That said, you know, I love – I don't know how many of your listeners saw Tina Fey when she was back on Saturday Night Live as the news broadcaster, and she had a great quote on this when Bush was proposing his version of earned citizenship. And she captured the extent that those who are here for more than 6 years would have a chance to stay in the country and earn citizenship through fines and security checks. Those between 3 and 6 years would have to return home but then come back after meeting the same requirements. And those here less than 3 years will be right back with your order. The problem is if you create a system that is too cumbersome and is too difficult for those undocumented immigrants to get legalized, you will, in fact, repeat the existing situation where there are those who will do everything they can to evade detection and not go about trying to regularize.
Yeah. I got some more callers here. I'd like to try and get some more folks in. We only have about 10 minutes left. Naperville, I think, is next. Line four. Hello.
Yeah, you guys have brought some great topics up here. The one thing that people seem to forget, though, the reason why everybody's up in arms is the welfare system. A lot of people just hate the fact that these people are getting away with basically getting freebies from the country. You know, I have hired seasonal workers in the past, and when you go through a stack of 200 people and you got one Caucasian or one American citizen, and the rest, one or two, and then the rest are Hispanic. And believe me, when I used to do landscape work for people, very hard, grueling work, these workers come in and they do a better job than the white guy. I didn't want to be, you know, racially motivated here, but the fact is it's true. You don't see a lot of landscapers with a high, you know, Caucasians. You don't see a lot of Burger Kings or McDonald's with Caucasians. People forget. These people come over here to make a better living. Now, the problem seems to be, you know, two things. One is the way that they come into this country. The immigration forms and everything, from what I knew, people, even my parents, I'm first-generation American. They had to jump all through the hoops and do all this stuff. Well, now it's like they're so overburdened by people wanting to come here for a better life that there's not enough people to go around, and the way the process is done is antiquated. That's one reason. Fix that. The other thing is they just see it for a security reason. I mean, it's like Dave said, I don't think it's physically impossible to go after these people. I mean, why would you if they're participating? It's just they're kind of taking advantage of the system. And I tell you, everyone that I've worked with have always been great workers. They've outproduced a lot of the people for little or no money. It makes sense to get rid of them, particularly since the average college kid doesn't want to work at a minimum wage job.
Yeah. You have raised a number of good points. I don't know what you'd like to pick up on.
Well, I thought that the caller was hitting on the two sort of hot button issues here simultaneously and revealing our dilemma, but I may have misinterpreted him. I thought he was simultaneously saying that a lot of immigrants come here and get on welfare and get freebies.
Right.
And then went on to say how hard they work. And I think actually I don't know he meant it this way, but I would say both of those things are true in the sense that there is evidence that there is, you know, use and increasing use of what people would call welfare programs or social welfare programs. Not as much as people think, not because people come here to get on welfare. They do come here to work. But, you know, life is complicated. Suddenly they lose jobs and then they have kids and wives and they're in difficult situations. So if their kids can qualify for something even though they can't, well, sure, they're going to take advantage of that. But I do think that both of those things are true. And the that's the dilemma in part that we're facing.
Just to disagree a bit, I think one of those things is more true than the other in the sense that, you know, A, there aren't a lot of immigrants that I haven't seen a lot of evidence are coming here to get freebies. I think Peter is right on in detecting what I noticed in the caller's comments in terms of noting come here to make a better living and also freebies. You know, it seems the vast majority of those coming here are hardworking and something that Peter didn't mention, pay taxes. So they're not getting something for nothing. And also, if you're undocumented, you're less likely to use the healthcare system and so forth. And so, you know.
Well, but I have to disagree.
Compared to the ordinary citizen, that's what the evidence suggests.
Yeah, but on balance, the notion that immigrants pay taxes, which they do, and that somehow, you know, compensates for the demands they place on public services generally, whether it's schools, hospitals, and so forth, is just not borne out by the evidence. That on balance, immigrants are low-income people, and as low-income people, they put more demands on our programs than they put in. I don't think there's any evidence to controvert that. Now, it plays out differently in different governmental sectors, but, you know, that's I think those are the facts.
Can I just – if you want to respond,
I was going to say, what you're doing is not calculating in those who stay and whose kids work here and then become integrated into the economy well. And so I think a lot of those studies end up being very targeted on immigrants during a certain particular period of time, their first years here, and are less so when one looks at the family's trajectory over you know, 20 years and the next generation and so forth.
We can save that for later.
Can I ask quickly a different kind of question? Do we make legal immigration too difficult?
Yes. That's the short answer for you.
do you think so?
Yeah. And we make it too difficult for more skilled people whom we could use more of. Yeah. And there's lots of ways we make it too difficult. Sure.
And along with job skills, is, you know, that's one of the central criteria for our preference system. There's also the issue of families, and right now, you know, most visas are reserved for family reunification. Yeah. But there are still many people who are on long waiting lists to get reunited with their families, and you know, it's very painful and very difficult. And those backlogs have been for years and years.
Right. Let's see if we can get one or two more callers next in line. Champagne line number two. Hello.
Yeah. I guess I'm confused about what exactly the problem is. Earlier, one of your guests talked about the Mexican elite shoving their poor across the border, but I believe that's not a real accurate statement. I mean, they may be doing that, but I think our elite, being business, are pulling them across the border also because... we don't have enough people to man low-paying jobs. It's not clear to me at all that either guest is considering the fact that borders are power constructs, and power is what's behind everything here, not fairness, not criminality, not morality, but just plain power, and that people will move where resources are, and borders will always be porous. Thank you.
All right.
Well, since I'm the guy who I think made that claim about Mexican elites, let me start, if I could. Well, look, the caller is correct that there's a complicity here among elites on both sides of the border, and that's one reason why we have the problem we have, but not the only reason. But his more general views is in my mind, much too cynical. I don't think borders are simply determined by power. I don't think anything in our social and political life is simply determined by power. Particularly in this country, we have notions of fairness and justice and rights that are also pretty influential and powerful. And I'm reminded this week after healthcare legislation is passed, last time I looked, that got justified in the name of something that was good for the American people. That means something to people. That's and that's defined in part, not completely, by our borders. So the notion that somehow these borders are artifacts of power or somehow phantasms, I just don't think it's true. And I think it's cuts against the grain of how most people live and think about themselves as Americans.
And very briefly, I mean, what strikes me is the extent to which we actually have less power over our borders than the caller might think. So, you know, if you look at just the geography of it, I mean, a 2,000-mile border with Mexico, in which whenever you have proposals to build a fence or a wall or so forth, it covers a very small proportion of that, as John Stewart and others like to mock. Mm-hmm. And then the Canadian border, would, you know, I think the most serious security challenges we face are actually along the Canadian border. And so there's actually less power that we have over these borders in terms of actually regulating them. I think where the power, and I think this is kind of what I suspect the caller is emphasizing, is the powers exercised once one crosses one of those porous borders, what one's membership rights are dramatically impacted by our lawmakers.
We essentially have to stop. My apologies. We have some callers we can't take. We have now demonstrated this issue is very complicated and there may be not a whole lot of consensus. People, I think, in Washington are going to continue to talk about doing something with it. Do you think that it's likely within the next year or two that we're going to see anything substantial happen in terms of immigration reform?
Briefly, certainly not before the election, and even after the election, I'm dubious.
And I agree completely. The pivot's going to be to jobs, climate change, regulation of Wall Street. You know, the talk on the Hill was that if we were going to get immigration reform done, it would be taken up in April and May. So one would want to look in those months, but it's not likely it's going to get done.
We're going to have to stop. However, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our two guests, Peter Skerry and Daniel Tischner. They're here for the Klein Symposium for the spring, looking at immigration issues, sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy. They'll be speaking at – there'll be a roundtable conversation this afternoon at 3, then tonight at 7:30, there'll be an evening event. They'll both be involved. That's at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. They're open to the public. You want to find out more about the Klein Center, go to their website, www.kleincenter.uiuc.edu. And again, our two guests, Peter Skerry, he's professor of political science at Boston College, and Daniel Tischner, he's professor of social science, senior faculty fellow at the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
I think this is kind of what I suspect the caller is emphasizing, is the powers exercised once one crosses one of those porous borders, what one's membership rights are dramatically impacted by our lawmakers.
We essentially have to stop. My apologies. We have some callers we can't take. We have now demonstrated this issue is very complicated and there may be not a whole lot of consensus. People, I think, in Washington are going to continue to talk about doing something with it. Do you think that it's likely within the next year or two that we're going to see anything substantial happen in terms of immigration reform?
Briefly, certainly not before the election, and even after the election, I'm dubious.
I agree completely. The pivot's going to be to jobs, climate change, regulation of Wall Street. You know, the talk on the Hill was that if we were going to get immigration reform done, it would be taken up in April and May. So one would want to look in those months, but it's not likely it's going to get done.
We're going to have to stop. However, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our two guests, Peter Skerry and Daniel Tischner. They're here for the Klein Symposium for the spring, looking at immigration issues, sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy. They'll be speaking at – there'll be a roundtable conversation this afternoon at 3, then tonight at 7:30, there'll be an evening event. They'll both be involved. That's at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. They're open to the public. You want to find out more about the Klein Center, go to their website, www.kleincenter.uiuc.edu. And again, our two guests, Peter Skerry, he's professor of political science at Boston College, and Daniel Tischner, he's professor of social science, senior faculty fellow at the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, David.
Thank you.